You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 67, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun and informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert, I'm thrilled to introduce as Dr. Josh Umber. I've been told by at least a half dozen guests that I needed to have him on, and so I finally relented. Dr. Umber is one of the partners who created Atlas MD, a direct primary care practice in Wichita, Kansas, and an electronic medical record system designed for direct primary cares, or DPCs. I wanted to have him on to discuss the commercial space of direct primary care and the products and commercial services springing up to serve it. We also discussed some interesting developments with federal laws and the political split within the American Academy of Family Practice, the main professional society for family docs. I'm sure you'll find the discussion as interesting and important for docs and patients as I did. Links to things we discussed can be found at my website, theparadox.com/067, and that's paradox with a C-S. If you haven't already, please take a moment to subscribe to the show and leave a rating. Also, for those interested, I've begun putting extra content up on my Patreon page, which I promised quite a while ago, and you can find that at www.patreon.com/theparadox, spelled the same way as before, which I intend to do weekly. It will be just an Amash update, totally unrelated to the content of this podcast, but I hope a fun behind-the-scenes look at what he thinks and what he's up to will be an interesting content that's an extra bonus for those who want to be a patron of the show. That extra content is available for those who support the show, and all the money raised, as always, is used for the production and promotion of the show. And again, you can find it at patreon.com/theparadox. But without further ado, this episode, what's the over-umber on direct primary care becoming the dominant force in primary care? Enjoy. Well, I'm delighted to have my new friend, Dr. Josh Umber, for joining the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I've had at least a half dozen of my former guests ask me why I haven't had you on the show. And so I felt some sort of obligation. I'm certainly following a lot of your public work, either through your writing or your public speaking, other interviews you've done. I have been remiss to not have you on the show. So I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. And I want to talk about some different things that I haven't talked to some other DPC docs today.
Excellent.
Specifically, give a little bit of your background. I mean, I mentioned the intro that you're at Atlas MD or DPC doc, but why don't you tell a little bit of your story, how you, because I think, you know, you're one of the pioneers. I talked to Neuhoffel, and Dr. Neuhoffel was sort of one of the first people to, you know, do DPC, at least that I can, at least there weren't a whole lot at that time. You were also, I think, an innovator in that sense too. Why don't you talk about how you got into it and what made you decide to do that, and I guess just your trajectory from out of residency into the DPC model?
Yeah, we had been watching this space for a long time. Kind of our origin story is that growing up, my dad was a trash man and ran a great business, and kind of in hindsight, it was a membership model. It was pick up once a week and yeah. You know, charge once a month, and it just was simple and made sense. And now he's a lawyer, so I still tell people he's a trash man, because significantly less embarrassing. So when I was in undergrad, I started working for a plastic surgeon who said he would hire me as his biller and coder. And I remember specifically asking him, what's that mean? And he said we would figure it out, and we just never really did. He was a brilliant cutter, and at the same time, not one that was, you know, wonderfully great at paperwork. And that was a realization that growing up, you're taught just work really hard, be good at what you do, and the rest will follow. And that wasn't true in medicine. It was a sloppy system where the sausage was getting made, and the spoil went to the person who was best at doing the paperwork, not necessarily the best as a surgeon. And from that point on, we started looking at alternatives, insurance-free models. Some were doing affordable fee-for-service. Some were doing the expensive concierge medicine. And honestly, I think the most helpful part of that was learning what didn't work.
Yeah.
Lots of doctors doing lots of things, but usually not adding value. Some would just say, well, cut my insurance costs in half. Well, $150 bill to the insurance that you got reimbursed $75, it cut in half to $75 is still more than what people's copay was. And so that would be fine if you came and brought other stuff, but it was so pervasive in the system that docs would say, no, the value is for me. Everything else is external. And we really took a different view of that.
Right. And so I guess my question then would be, so you did your residency, your family practice, I believe, correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So you finished your family practice residency. You'd already sort of seen what was kind of broken in medicine, I guess, ahead of time. And did you have a number of partners or people you're training with who were sort of had the same ideas or the idea that you need to do things differently and you went into a joint venture, or was this a solo thing?
A bit of both. You know, the nice thing about sharing call with your residency colleagues is they're a captive audience. They couldn't necessarily walk away. It was that, listen to me tell you know, my vision for stuff or go do an admit. So I would tell everybody, you know, how I pictured this working. And Dr. Doug, my partner and co-founder, really latched onto that idea and saw the value of that. His dad had been a hospital administrator for 40 years. So he had seen kind of the other half of medicine being run and also heavily bureaucratic and the struggle from that side to improve it. So it really was kind of a nice blend of skill sets, hand in glove. And then when we came out, we just took a fresh eye. Since neither one of us had run a clinic before, it was really easy to kind of not make the same mistakes.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because you know, when you talk about the plastic surgeon be really good at being a surgeon and not very good at the, we'll say the business aspects. I mean, I know a lot of the business is sort of phony baloney stuff with it, filling out insurance forms and prior authorizations and things like that. But essentially that the business aspect of medicine is important too. And I think people look at the DPC and they say, well, this is a great model. This is, you know, practicing medicine the way I want. And they kind of forget the fact that you're also a small businessman or businesswoman, and you have to be able to manage all those other parts of a business, you know, your marketing, your overhead expenses and things like that. And if you don't do that well, you also can't be, you might not be successful. And so there's certainly an extra element of risk with the DPC.
I think a big reason that doctors don't embrace the business side of it is we're just historically taught not to. I know my med school specifically showed old artwork of doctors taking money backhanded or under the table, that a business is bad, profit is bad. It's unbecoming and unprofessional of a physician to worry about these things. But then look where that got us. Ignorance is not bliss. Burying our hand in sand is not a solution. Now we had this infiltration of administrators all raising the cost of things. Our med school professors did not work for free. So ignoring it doesn't change. It's like ignoring your cancer. But we never thought that we could take responsibility for it. If business is so bad, there's no right way to do it. And I would say, you know, a lot of hospitals did it wrong. And so that reinforced the concept. They didn't even know that there was a solution that they could reach for. So it was funny that we would ask, you know, big pharma and government and insurance, we both say that they're part of the problem and then ask them to fix it.
Right.
And why would we give why would we give the people who broke it the authority to fix it? So when we said, okay, we are going to come out with a different pricing model and we're not going to take insurance, now we have to justify ourselves. And we have to justify that with value. And to do that, we need to adopt anything and everything from business that can help us help our patients. And then when you kind of frame it like that, now everything seems like a great opportunity. How do we get meds cheaper? How do we get labs cheaper? How do we provide, you know, the most cost-effective EKG or Holter services or whatever? And then that extends into, in a lot of ways, how do I set my pricing? Well, that depends on my overhead and my staff and my patient panel size and what value I can bring to them. Because if I don't do wholesale meds, some docs will say, try to charge the same amount. You can't charge the same amount and do less.
Yeah.
So then I need to see more patients. And, you know, and then there comes a friction point there. So we're very good problem solvers. If someone comes to you with a migraine, every headache's a migraine, but we tease out the wheat from the chaff with our patients to identify the right type of headache and the right treatment, et cetera. So we can apply a lot of those same skills to the business of what is the most effective marketing? How do I add value? How do I innovate? How do I help my patients in a way that doesn't involve insurance? It's actually kind of exciting. I think opens up a whole new part of a physician's brain that they've been waiting to scratch and just didn't know that itch was there.
Yeah, no, I think there's no question about that. And the money aspect of medicine is very interesting too, because I absolutely remember that one during medical school that is very much frowned upon, that the fact there's any sort of monetary exchange in taking care of people. But, you know, we take care of each other all the time in so many different ways. And at no time do you feel like people shouldn't be compensated for that. I mean, I think no one would think that they shouldn't pay their priest or their, you know, the pastor to minister to the sick and, you know, for funerals and things like that. So I don't understand why we've taken this approach in medicine that,
oh, it's uniquely a physician problem.
Yeah. Well,
patients expect to not, you know, have to pay.
Right.
They pay at the pharmacy counter, they pay at the lab, they pay their insurance. Is because we didn't connect ourselves to that value and that payment. The physician, we kind of taught the patients that we're worth our copay, and we gave them a very low value for that.
Yeah.
So no wonder they were frustrated paying for that. Now, I can pay for a budget hotel room or a fantastic hotel room. I'm still going to sleep in both of them for 8 hours. I'm going to be unconscious of the value around me, but one of them figures out a way to provide, you know, to get a higher fee and a happier customer. So it does force physicians to take a little bit more of the lead role and show patients directly, you're paying me and I'm providing a value to you. And I love the classic Hollywood line, of course, it's nothing personal, it's only business.
Right, yeah, right.
That guy gets shot by the good guy. I think in medicine or the other argument, the academic argument is medicine is too important to be left to a business. Again, I would disagree with.
Yeah.
It is vitally important. And I find a few things more personal than that relationship is you're quite literally feeding my family. In exchange, I'm caring for the health and well-being of yours. And there's no middleman now. There's me, a nurse, and a patient. And that's about it. So I can't run from it. We have to embrace it. We have to build a good relationship of mutual trust and benefit between the doctor and the patient. But so they can now fully appreciate that when I respond back to them at Friday at 9 o'clock to their text about a sick child, it's me.
Yeah,
and
right.
Not just another doctor who's paid to be on call that they don't know and don't feel a connection to. So as we build our emotional connection, we prove our value and worth to our patients.
Yeah, I think I've never really thought of it before, but I think the aspect of insurance and that you have this third party in between in the payment process, that in many ways it makes a physician feel as if the patient really has no skin in the game. They're not really pay anything. And so that they are sort of providing care for free to that patient and that their perception is that the patient, you know, doesn't pay anything. And by the same token, the patient may feel the same way as well. And so because that value, like you said, is missing, it makes it feel like for physicians that you are kind of doing things for free. And so that if you start looking at it as any sort of financial transaction involved in this process, that it's kind of dirty. When it that was always happening, it was just kind of more in the background maybe, and that it was not a direct direct transaction with the patient. And so
the,
I can
the
see
funny
how
thing is there were countless transactions.
Oh yeah.
You know?
No kidding.
Even more expensive. We feel bad when we made it cheaper. No, it's so silly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole thing is kind of crazy that it's devolved into where it is. I suppose, you know, you could look back and you'd say, well, that's how it would have happened. And I have not been able to meet someone who was practicing in the 1950s because they're, you know, mostly long gone, and just know what it was like back then. I mean, I think it probably, I mean, obviously it was different because there wasn't really an insurance model at that time. But anyway, you know, we are in the system we are in. My
I love
impression,
a quote, if you want a new idea, read an old book.
Right. Right.
We random set of circumstances, a liberal radio talk show was complaining about Sean Hannity. And I said, you know, we don't like anything he says. But he had this doc on the other day. And the lady they were interviewing was Professor Christy Ford Chaplin. And she's a medical economic historian. Yeah. Of sub specialties, and that she was, oh my God, that's exactly what my book is on, or the first half of it, of that in the 20s and 30s, this is what we had. She called them prepaid medical, but there were clinics and you'd pay a fee all the time and they'd provide you care. And she talked about the economic benefits. It's, you know, beautifully self-balancing, because if you do too much, you go bankrupt. If you don't do enough value, then you don't show your work to the patients. So then, you know, again, all things come back around.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing new under the sun, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, that's true.
So that kind of brings me to the next question. And one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on to discuss, because I feel like direct primary care, or even direct care, we'll say, just even for specialists, is growing. And I don't know if you feel that as well. I mean, I feel like it's not exponential growth, but I feel like we're approaching the point where it's going to start really getting a lot bigger. By that token, the commercial aspect of who's involved in this arena now seems to be growing quite a bit too, because I now see consultants, I see people advertising products and services to what, you know, before was such a small niche that it wasn't even a niche, right? But do you get that impression too, that it's now getting to the point where there's actually a market for ancillary services to provide the sort of people opening their own clinics?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's a growing pain. You know, we're probably moving from infant and toddler stage to awkward adolescence. As DPC grows, now it's something of value, which is wonderful in the sense that they said 10 years ago, this wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, that's kind of, you know, par for any innovation. It took Starbucks 17 years to get 17 stores, and we have over 1,000 doctors doing DPC in 10. Because I think some people say, well, if this is so great, why isn't it everywhere? It really kind of is on a great trajectory. But internally, we can show, you know, that the movement is growing at least 50, 60% year over year.
Yeah.
And which, you know, small now, but I think there'll be a FOMO for physicians, that fear of missing out, saying I can transfer my own clinic and retain those patients and build my model. But the longer I stay in insurance, the less those patients have a connection to me, because the less time I can spend with them. Mm-hmm. So the pain of staying in is going to be greater than the pain of change. You know, when we started, it was the opposite. But now, as that does grow bigger, there are people who say, you know, how can we either support or utilize this movement for different gains? And that's great. I think the physicians so far have done a really good job of evaluating who's adding value and who's not. There has been any number of middlemen who will want to come and kind of subcontract, sell at a higher price to a company and then subcontract it out to a physician for a lower price. It shows the resiliency. This is a little bit like the internet. There's just so many different unrelated nodes of DPC. You can't really take it out in one shot. I think the healthcare market has and will continue to be very difficult in the sense that it's always messy. It's bureaucratic. It's highly regulated. It doesn't respond to change as quickly as other industries. But you take something like the Him and Hers company that is the newest Silicon Valley unicorn for healthcare, basically selling birth control, acne medicine, hair loss, and Viagra. Well, they're selling generic Viagra for $34 a pill that we can get wholesale for 11 cents. No wonder you're valued at $30 billion, because you have a markup on a product that no other industry would ever allow.
Yeah, right.
And it won't for much longer. Short sell if they're going for IPO, because it just, those kind of things can't work. My favorite economist, and you know you're a nerd when you have a favorite economist.
Yeah, that pretty much puts you in that class.
It's half a mnemonic there. But Milton Friedman would call this an economic cartel, and they just never last. And I think what DPC is doing is breaking those economic cartels. So to be successful in this space, you have to show a Jeff Bezos or Sam Walton style passion for lowering the cost and raising the value and improving the system. So a group that just comes in and continues to sell marked up pills at outrageous prices won't last long in a DPC world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously someone just taking advantage of a quirk in the market that, as you said, will eventually fade away at some point. So one of the big banes of physicians right now is the electronic medical record. If physicians listening, just mentioning EHR or EMR will want to bash their head into a wall. And for patients, you go visit your physician and they're spending a lot of time on the computer, or they've hired someone, a scribe, to sit there and sort of type everything out while they're talking so they don't have to do the typing themselves. But I mean, you recognize a big inefficiency within the system. But without a doubt, computerization is something that should absolutely increase productivity, make it ways of providing better care, better communication of problems. I mean, I remember talking to a veterinarian once, and he actually had developed his own EHR of some sort, and he was talking about how great it was. And he's like, doctors are dumb that they can't use computers, right? I mean, he's right in some level, but it's because our computers are designed, or programs, I should say, were basically designed for capture of data that is used for third parties, like, demographic data, or for billing. And it's not actually for patient information and to, relay useful clinical findings and things like that, which people will not believe is actually the case. I mean, yes, those components are within all the EMRs. You can find all that stuff, but it's not easily accessible. It's just not designed, or like a note that I get from a family practice physician will have very little information that is useful to me in providing anesthetic for someone. And right. I have to dig through 6 pages to get, I don't care if you wear a seatbelt. It doesn't really matter to me. I don't care what most things are not irrelevant, whether you have a history of cancer in your family. It's not relevant to me. But I know that the DPC docs, they've utilized computers because they actually are helpful. So how have you, because you have your own, I think you have your own software, correct, with Atlas MD?
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you obviously imagine it's developed because you just needed something for your record keeping. I mean, you either use a paper or you're going to use a computer, right? You sort of have those two options.
Yeah, I think docs do get a bad rap for being kind of technophobes. But for most of them, an EMR is a 4-letter word. But it's we don't judge all tech, we judge the tech, I think. And you see every other doctor walking around loving their iPhone, or Galaxy or whatever, but they're adopting those kind of things. They're using all kinds of technology around them, whether it's smart cars or tablets or email or text messaging or social media. They adopt these things pretty well. So they can learn tech. The point is, the tech that they're working on to do their job is bad. And it's bad because the mission is wrong. And the mission is billing insurance and making administrators happy, not providing patient care. So when you ask a different question, how do we streamline the process of taking care of patients in a doctor and small business friendly way? It ends up being, I think, a very easy question to answer. And we were able to just carve the stone away from the marble, like Michelangelo would say, and in a very logical way, okay, well, docs need a way to schedule and do these other pieces. In the first 6 months of our practice, we combined 9 different software programs running parallel to each other just for the practice, the business of running the business. It was impossible. Charting, texting, emailing, scheduling, billing, labs, pharmacy inventory, labels, all these things. And it's kind of like if you give a moose a muffin, the kids' little storybooks, if you're billing outside of insurance, you need QuickBooks. And if you're doing that, you need another thing and another thing.
Yeah.
And if you're dispensing meds, you need pharmacy software. And then if you do that, you need lab software. And if you're doing those, you're going to need to ship patients' meds. So you need shipping software and things that 99% of EMRs just never even broached, because if insurance doesn't reimburse it, we're not building for it. And vice versa, cutting away the noise, we didn't care about IC 9 or 10 or 11 or whatever is next, or macro or MIPS. We have one specific mission, and it's providing, you know, very cost effective care. Now the EMR ideally should just be a tool like your iPhone. You can, you know, manage patients, you get their texts, their emails, their phone calls in one source. You can dispense their meds. It pulls it out of inventory. It adds it to their bill. It texts them their tracking number for all effortlessly. That's what, you know, good tech iPhone-esque would do for the practice of medicine, ours or anybody who makes that. And then physicians get to focus back on what matters, which is finding solutions for patient care.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, the reason that physicians are so upset, as you said, it's because the technology doesn't work in the way it should work to make your job easier. It makes the job more painful or more difficult or more time consuming. Mm-hmm. And no one would ever adopt anything by choice that actually makes your job harder. I mean,
well, look at the outrage just this week alone. Apple updated their default mail app and moved the delete icon too close to the reply icon, and everybody lost their mind. because it's a tool they use all the time, and it just got a tiny bit worse. Patients would never tolerate using an EMR built for Windows 95, but doctors suffer with that every day. So I would say it's not even insurance's fault.
No,
it was a weird Cold War of sorts where, all right, we want, you know, 5 review systems. Like, all right, now we'll just build software and make every patient automatically a 5. Like, okay, well then we were doing that because that would slow you down and we wouldn't have to pay you as much. So now that it's automated, we want 6 or 7, then, you know, medical decision-making. So that's where we get those charts that don't mean anything. Like you mentioned, my favorite orthopedic group, my favorite note from them, 16-year-old amenorrheic male. I mean, like, technically, yes, they should be, you know, but maybe you just got a little click happy on your EMR. But hey, got to hit all the buttons to get reimbursed, because it goes back to the plastic surgeon from earlier. It didn't matter what you did. It's how you document what you might've done or what you did do that matters how you get paid. So a flawed system would result in flawed software 100 out of 100 times.
Yeah, no question. I mean, I can't tell you how many notes I get from where I'm doing pediatric dental cases where the kids all have, you know, lots of cavities. That's why they have to have general anesthesia, and the oral exam is normal.
Right? There you go. Exactly.
But then on the diagnosis, it has dental caries, right? You know, they've got cavities. So, I mean, frankly, I don't really look at that stuff anyway, because for the same reason, it's usually meaningless, because people,
it is.
It's a templated and they don't really, you know, write anything down. It's terrible in many ways, but it's because we are rewarded for things that are not actually helpful. And so you respond to incentives.
Blame the insurance company. I try to put all the blame on physicians, and in part because we blamed everyone else and that didn't work. But then that gives us the authority to fix it too. So if we say, well, our notes don't mean anything, but they bill great, that should see us as a problem. But we also shouldn't be needing insurance. If our patients need insurance to get treatment for strep throat or diabetes or blood pressure or a UTI, then that's a failure on our part, not a failure on the insurance. If gasoline becomes expensive, then we might insure it, but it won't because of a good market. And so we should have been looking for ways like, yeah, okay, if you want to use your insurance, that's fine, but I can give you an affordable price and I can do an A1C for $2.25 and I can do 1,000 metformin for $11. So then we would not make insurance go away because it's bad. We would make insurance go away because it's unnecessary.
Yeah, right.
I still have life insurance and I know I'm going to die. I mean, it's not even a risk. It's a guarantee, but it's the risk is win. And so long-term between pay in and pay out, very simple paperwork, no headaches and hassles. We could get like health insurance back to something very reasonable like that as well. If doctors innovate solutions at the point of care and put the patient first.
Yeah. So the one problem, maybe problem is the wrong word, but the one thing that's holding back a greater adoption of the DPC, because certainly when I talk to physicians who are in primary care, there is without a doubt a desire to have a practice that runs like a DPC, where you have more time with the patient, you have a smaller patient panel, you know your patients better, you're providing all this value, and you have that, especially for primary care, you have a better relationship with the patient, which is, you know, why you go into medicine generally. But one of the things that are slowing down the adoption is the tremendous medical debt that we come out of medical school with, which is, you know, $250,000 or $150,000. It's a lot. And so that's a big deterrent. And so people get sucked into some employed model, generally speaking. Is there a big movement within DPC for getting to the medical schools and telling people about this? Because I feel like that's, you know, getting med students to rotate through a DPC practice would be very valuable. And I just don't know how often that's done.
I think it's happening actually quite a bit. We used to talk about burnout in older physicians and then kind of middle-aged physicians and new docs. Now we're talking about burnout in med students, which is amazing. But the beautiful part about them is they don't have a dog in this hunt. All they really want is to come out and be able to provide great care. They want what everybody else wants, you know, a good salary, some predictability, but they also don't want to deal with the stress of the insurance, which they used to not see until, you know, residency or after. They're seeing now in med school, and they don't like it either. But they just want to see the system that gives them, you know, more pluses than minuses. So when they're exposed to DPC, and what I think ultimately happens is they see happy doctors who are providing full scope care, who are passionate, who are helping their patients, and they follow that. It's intoxicating to some degree, because the reverse is definitely true. A burned out doctor who hates family medicine and is grumpy in his clinic and yelling at his nurses and kicking his dog, that's contagious. They're definitely going to avoid that. So every opportunity that they see is like, well, this is a beacon of something good, and I want more of that. And I tell my students and my friends, colleagues, that's the kind of doctor I want. I want to be able to text. I want to laugh with my patients. I want to spend 30 minutes with them. I want to do procedures or save them $100 on their medicine and see them, you know, rejoice that it's 30 cents a month and not $100 a month. And so that alone, the same value we're bringing to patients, we're kind of bringing to ourselves and our colleagues. So I think most doctors who are doing DPC have been asked to talk at their med schools, have students rotating through, and are kind of really the loud minority spreading a bigger message, because no one else is defending the status quo. No one's coming out and saying you will be happier doing insurance. You should see 40 people a day. No, 50, because I'll pay you more if you're 50. You know, stuff like that. So I think it makes for an easy win.
Well, it's interesting because I feel like, why don't you go into a little bit of discussion on the tension that I feel right now within the family practice professional society, their physicians, and the DPC community. I know there's like some pending legislation as we record this in the federal government. I can't remember the House bill, but it's
House bill 3708.
Mm-hmm. 3708. Yeah. So you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep.
What is the tension between the professional society? Because I mean, family practice, I suppose family practice and internal medicine would be the two main DPC professional societies that have the DPC docs in them. What's the mood within those organizations, with their leadership, with their base, and with the DPC docs and sort of the federal and the sort of the federal milieu of regulatory and legislation?
Sure. I think a key part of this is just understanding that there's what you want, and then there's what comes out the other end, and those are usually not the same. And so the Congress is a GI tract. They'll take filet mignon and turn it into a pile of and I've never seen them go the opposite way. They never take a bad idea and make it into an amazing one. And so we had, for years, a very simple bill, H.R. 365, I think, almost two sentences long, saying as simply as possible, one, DPC is not insurance. Two, DPC is an approved HSA expense. Please leave us alone. And for the past 2 years, we've actually, had to fight for our effective lives because the bills got so bad. And, it's 400 plus different Congress people who get to have an opinion on it, then Senate, and most of who, are divided strongly on party lines. And so now some people will try to add poison pills to the bill that you're trying to use to help people. And we just haven't found that to end up ultimately being an avenue worth exploring. So the H.R. 365 that got rolled up into several bad bills became H.R. 6199 last year that we fought tooth and nail to kill for a variety of the similar reasons. Is being revived as H.R. 3708. And it does four things specifically that on its face may not sound bad, but if you don't apply that to the realm of DPC, you don't really appreciate how bad it is. One, it effectively eliminates the ability of physicians to dispense wholesale meds, in part because retail farm like CVS are a large backer of this bill. PBMs have more money than the pharmacy companies combined.
Right.
Our ability to decrease the cost of the medicine by 99% because we don't involve them. It's between the patient and the physician. It never even goes to the insurance company and the pharmacy. So this bill would make dispensing wholesale medicines an HSA disqualifying event. So an HSA bill or the idea of HSAs yeah. to increase consumerism would then slash heavily at this. Furthermore, because of the way the politics of this work, this is less someone's bad, more of the system is broken. It went through a financial committee, the Ways and Means, which means it has to be scored by the JCT on taxes and taxes only. So any additional gain from people having $100 extra in their in their pocket every month because of cheaper medicine doesn't get accounted. So they said, well, if 100% of the households use 100% of their HSA, the federal government will lose X in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So then we need to put a cap on this so that even if they did use their HSA, they couldn't spend any more than X amount. It would effectively be the first time in history that physicians have had a price cap like this, and it would be only applied to direct care physicians. So if you were an insurance-based doctor and you charged $300 for a wellness exam or any other procedure, you can charge whatever you want. You charge $1,000 per visit, and a patient could pay an HSA with it. In fact, a patient could buy an Apple Watch that costs more than the monthly DPC fees every month with their HSA dollars, but they couldn't pay for a doctor. What it really does is hampers the future of DPC combined with the next piece. Also to bring that scoring part of the bill down, they said, well, we'll only allow this for primary care. That way we can say no other specialty group will have this kind of savings, so we won't lose this kind of tax dollars. So then we could never have direct autistic care. We could never have direct drug rehab. We could never have direct cardiology and direct neurology. We have direct pediatric endocrinology right now in San Antonio, Texas. And these things would become HSA disqualifying events. So this bill, in the final just horrificness, would qualify DPC as a type of insurance So now the federal government at the IRS would call this insurance, and 27 states have passed legislation to say that DPC is not insurance. So for your average small practice who is both already a little afraid of running a small business and of insurance in the government, would require, you know, small practices of two or three doctors to fight the IRS to say we're not insurance. I think this would set our patient care back a decade, but I think it'll set patients back a decade. It effectively decreases DPC's ability to operate, let alone any future opportunity to innovate even more value for our patients. And, you know, this is one of those things, when they come for us, they'll come for the other doctors next. So if you're an insurance-based doctor or a plastic surgeon or specialist and you think you'll be able to continue charging $500, if all they want to do is show a tax savings, then with the strike of a pen, they can cap every other physician's salaries at any time. So we really do feel like we're fighting the good fight here for the short, middle, and long term.
So in summary, this bill would just affect people who are using HSAs, which is a small portion of the market. Is that correct, or is that a larger portion of people who are going to DPCs are people who have HSAs?
Well, what it would do is one, very muddy the lines, and two, it'll change a lot between now and the Senate. And mm-hmm. what we've only seen is it'll only get worse as they add more words to it. In essence, a patient utilizing a DPC clinic in any capacity wouldn't be able to utilize a health savings account. So they wouldn't be able to utilize a high deductible insurance right. and a health savings account. So it would drive them away. They'd say, look, I love the, you know, $100 I'm saving with you, but if not, I have to, it completely invalidates the $6,000 I want to save every month in a tax-free way.
Yeah.
So I'll go and spend $3,000 in care over the course of the year that I don't need to, but it's the only way for me to get the other $3,000 that I can actually save in a tax-friendly way. So it doesn't directly stop a doctor from doing it, but it does stop a patient from participating in it if they choose to, which is, you know, really the opposite of the HSA bill, but freedom in general is this strict grip on what is approved and what's not. Now, we'll continue approving hot tubs and Apple Watches,
yeah, right.
all kinds of things, you know, cosmetic surgery for HSAs. Legal fees are an HSA allowable expense, but not medical care will no longer be a health savings account qualified expense. If it doesn't just look ridiculous on its face, then I have done a good job.
Yeah. What is the role then of the professional society? Because I know a lot of physicians have been really upset with the American Association of Family Physicians?
American Academy of Family Physicians. Yeah. Sean Martin sold us out. And I'll say that again. Sean Martin sold us out. You know, it's a hot debate going on both Facebook and Twitter, but then a lot of passionate physicians are emailing and calling their senators. The AFP supports a bill that will cap our charges, in which case I would support a bill that caps the ability of the professional organization on my dues.
Yeah,
but oh, wait, that doesn't make any sense. They raise my dues every year because they feel like as a business, they need more money to do more things for me. But then as a physician and a customer of theirs, they're limiting my ability to make that money. I think it's always interesting to, you know, kind of invert like that. If it's not good for the goose, it's not good for the gander, then let's make them accept all physicians, whether they're family or not. But make them do their CME for free. Make them do everything at a price, a fraction of what it could be. Well, they would say the same thing. Well, if you don't pay us more, we'll never be able to innovate. We'll never be able to afford to make new CME. We won't be able to do trade journals and educate doctors. Oh, okay. So if you want the right to run your business like you see fit, then we expect the American Academy of Family Physicians to support family physicians' ability to innovate as they see fit. And a group like that, it's almost cannibalistic that they would support a bill not only directly harming their customer base as physicians, but that would directly harm patients, their ability to get wholesale meds, to get affordable care, to get affordable insurance. You know, when taken to its full Socratic extent, it's scary how damaging a professional organization is not to support a bill like this.
What is the motivation for it then? I mean, what did they get out of it? I mean, I understand, for instance, I understand the AMA by sort of going along with the introduction of Medicare. They got the CPT coding bills, and so they got a lot of, they were able to publish the books, and they get a lot of revenue from it. What does the AFP get out of this bill? It doesn't sound like it'd be advantageous to anyone within their organization.
Oh, you know, I mean, at the risk of sounding, you know, tinfoil hat, it's I'm sure it's money.
Well, I imagine it is. I'm just kind of trying to figure out where.
Yeah, no, we've asked them this same question and they have never answered it. Okay. And I think that's part of the problem. I think they say, well, we try to do a lot of things and it's hard to please everybody and politics is messy. No, your support of a bad bill is because you could reverse it and say, we want amendments. We want to improve a bad bill. Let's work hard to make it a good bill. And I think what they were not expecting is how passionate the direct care movement is. For a lot of physicians, this is the only thing that kept them in medicine. That they would have left long ago if they had to continue practicing insurance-based medicine. So they feel completely kind of thrown to the wolves by their own professional society, with not even the courtesy of Sean Martin giving us a fair and open explanation of why they would support capping physicians like this. I think they have more to gain in an insurance-based model than they do from an insurance-free model, or at least they think they do. So we're actively working hard. Some docs choose to, opt out and cancel their membership to send a message. Some are trying to work through the powers that be to get them. This is the fastest growing movement in medicine.
Yeah,
and it's kind of sad that they support it in some ways, which is what they will say, and they have. They've done excellent work funding DPC conferences and whatnot, but at the same time, you can't say, well, just because I fed you a lot of healthy meals, you can't be mad at me when I feed you a little cyanide. Oh no, I'll be very mad. You know, there's no cyanide to healthy food ratio here. You sell us down the river, you sell us down the river regardless of the previous good deeds. Let's instead work on continuing a grand future of good deeds and put this bad bill behind us, or at least use it to our benefit.
Do you suppose one of the reasons is that there's I can only guess that in most professional organizations, my assumption is that they are, the leadership is traditionally are more academic physicians who are, well, they're obviously not in private practice or outside in the market, because they take up a lot of time, and you in your private practice, you have to schedule out time. You're going to do these things, and it's oftentimes not compensated, and we've got families and things like that. And so for the academic types, it's easier to make these sort of meetings. It's easier to sort of commit this time as sort of your paid time, as your salaried position, of going to conferences and things like that. Is this an academic versus private kind of battle a little bit on some level? I mean, at the leadership at AFP, I mean, I'm trying to make sense of, I know you don't have exact answers, but is that how the leadership is within the AFP?
You know, I do think sometimes it comes down to the academics of it. And that's not to say anything bad about it, but there's a great book, The Richest Man in Babylon, which is a lot of common sense information, but long story short, rich man gives poor man advice and poor man tries it and fails and comes back and says, what did I do wrong? And the rich man says, I told you to do a diamond deal with the diamond guy and you did a diamond deal with a blacksmith. Now, blacksmiths are great for a blacksmith deal. And what we have is academics trying to do a free market thing, and they're rarely in a free market space.
Right.
So they don't know how to run a practice. They don't know about wholesale meds. They don't know about billing insurance. They've never had to do MACRA and MIPS on their own. They're part of a giant system that does it for them, and they're salaried regardless, most of the time at a greater percentage for research than patient care. So they're insulated from these things. And they still probably hold on to, if I'm being kind of far-reaching here, that bias that business and medicine is bad.
Sure.
So they haven't seen the benefit. You know, I love a book, a good profit. There's good profit and there's bad profit. And we're making good profit because we brought the cost of chemo breast cancer treatments down from $600 or $700 to $6. Brought the cost of migraine treatments down to $5. And we do stitches that would cost $1,000 or $2,000 at the ER, we do for free. So we're in a space where we see the results of our innovation, and they're not necessarily in a space where they would see that all the time. So I can't fault them for it, but I can fault them for trying to speak up in a scenario where they're, you know, unfamiliar. If you do research on lungs and someone is asking about a spleen, you should probably say, "Hey, I'm not a spleen guy."
Yeah.
And this is where academics meets real world. There is just a difference between the two.
Yeah, I think there are times when we bring things to the attention of the legislators, and we get exactly the opposite of what we had hoped. And
amen.
I hope it's easier to ask for forgiveness and permission sometimes. And I hope this doesn't end up in the wrong direction at the end. I mean, I always assume sort of like the movie, the good guys win in the end, but sometimes it takes a while to get to where we want to go.
It's never a smooth path. If anything, I'll take it as a compliment. My buddy, Lee Gross, fought to get a DPC friendly bill passed in Florida for 5 or 6 years, not because they didn't like it, but because they liked it. And so that made it a political football every year. And then nobody wants to get rid of a great political football. So, yes, you know, you extend it into the next year. And I would say affectionately, I don't care for either party. The left has tried solutions for healthcare that didn't work. The right is probably struggling to come up with a decent idea. The fact that they latch on to this as anything can be viewed as a plus, that it's getting some level of bipartisan support. We're just doing it wrong. And we want to make sure that there's a great book, Permissionless Innovation, that says just this, like, let us kind of move fast and break things. We're already very well regulated. We're licensed. We're monitored. We're not changing the medicine or the treatment of medicine, but we're changing the delivery of that. So it's very patient safe. And nothing else has worked. So do we really want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, or, you know, choke this horse with regulation before it's left the barn? I don't think so. So now we just kind of have to protect it from itself. But it is getting the attention. So that I'm happy about that.
Yeah. Well, there's no question that you'll see certain things that come to the forefront on off year elections. Abortion's one.
Yes.
Gun rights. And that is because it's a low for fundraising for both parties. And so they will bring these issues that they know are not going to get resolved, but they can threaten that the other side is going to do something, and that's how they maintain their fundraising, those off year elections. And we had the same thing in anesthesia. There's the battles and scope of practice in our state. And it's against the interests of all the politicians to have anything have it resolved, because people continue sending money to them to prevent the bill or to pass the bill. Right. And so it's like that all. And so maybe it's the same for this sort of thing too.
I hope so. I hope they don't fully pass it. Yeah. I do think both sides mean well. One thing we've heard this week from Republican legislators reading the bill is, oh, on its face, I thought it sounded okay. I thought the average price was below $150 cap anyways. Well, yes, no, maybe. What if I wanted to do direct autism care and include some speech and physical therapy and occupational therapy? Oh, boy, we never thought you would do that. Well, yeah, as this movement grows, I think there's a lot of opportunities. So they feel like they're doing the right thing. We just have to kind of help educate and explain where this helps and where this hurts.
You are far too kind. I don't think they're actually their interests are yours most of the time, and I think their ignorance is true at times, but also insincere. And I think they are oftentimes responding to the market signals for them is the large check they get from the PBMs or whoever.
I think the nice way of saying it is their confidence far exceeds their intellect.
Yes, I think there's a lot of truth there. Any more than you'd expect me to give you very good sound legal advice. I would expect a punch to give sound medical advice or how the industry works. Well, it's been a great discussion. How are ways that people can find you, follow you, and I guess the products you have?
So we try to be as available to physicians as possible or patients to answer questions. This truly is a grassroots movement. So we provide as much material and consulting as we can for free to doctors, everything soup to nuts to start their own practice. We want direct care to grow fast and well, avoid as many little friction points as possible if we're all sharing best practices. So Twitter at AtlasMD, Facebook at AtlasMD. The best email to reach the general group is hello@atlas.md. And we just want to grow this movement. So every doctor, patient, employer who's curious about making DPC successful,
yeah,
we're happy to chat.
Well, and the great thing I found about just about all the DPC docs now, maybe it's partly a selection bias, the ones who tend to be more vocal, but all very passionate and all, and even like talking to somebody like Keith Smith, with the Surgery Center of Oklahoma, people that are not, they're not concerned about people taking their model and, doing something different to it. They're very passionate about the model itself and the different concepts, and they want to spread that idea. It's like a, it is almost like proselytizing.
It is.
It's sort of, that's how everybody is with it. It's really great that someone just believes in something so strongly that they think everybody should do it. And, and I don't care if you do it better than me, right? It's sort of, I just want everyone to experience what I'm experiencing because I think it's just transformed my life or, whatever.
Well, we've been accused of building a religion before in DPC total, but you're right, because if one doctor, figures an extra thing out, we all learn from. The CEO of Costco said once that every good idea we've had, we've stolen. For DPC being sort of anti, or docs being unfamiliar with the business, we're inherently practicing a lot of the things that make business incredibly successful. The inventor of the seatbelt was a Volvo engineer, and they gave that patent away to everyone to save lives. Elon Musk is opening up most of their patents to move the industry forward as quickly as possible. So doctors don't see themselves as each other as competition. They see it as a virtuous business cycle. If I do something better and I can share that, then we're all doing it a little bit better. If now 1,000 docs are each making us just even a fraction of a little bit better every year, now we go from iPhone 1 to iPhone 11. We go from a nice thing to a supercomputer of value. And our patients are the ultimate benefactor of all of that.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great way to end. And I think just the fact that we all have a little bit of humility, some doctors more than others, but definitely the recognition that there may be a better way to do things and that innovation, not only just in how you treat, but also the way people are treated and cared for is important to keep in mind. So, Dr. Umber, thank you so much for the afternoon.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.